What's up, everybody? It's time for Tom Walkinshaw, a name that we have mentioned and a bit of story we've told in previous episodes, but now Tom is getting his whole episode, his own episode. Today, we are going to learn about some of the crazy cars that he was behind, some of the rule bending that he was behind as well. Every great racer, every great team leader in motorsport has probably bent the rules and not got caught. Well, Tom did get caught a couple times, led to some controversy, as they say, across the pond. This is a good episode, cool episode, a lot of cool Jags, a lot of cool Holdens. Yeah, let's get right into it. Le Mans, June of 1988. For the past 7 years, Porsche had held tight to the checkered flag at the legendary 24-hour race. But a Scotsman minus the kilt had announced that he was prepared to loosen the German grip on victory. This year, as the sun set over the Cirque de la Sarthe, a gaggle of racers led by Tom Walkinshaw, sitting behind the wheel of a half-dozen well-sorted Jaguar XJR 9LMs, were ready to make that happen. Lap after lap, the iconic silk-cut sponsored purple and yellow Jag streaked through the field and screamed down the legendary Mulsanne straight, its monstrous 7-liter V12 echoing across the fields beyond the track. Jan Lammers, one-third of the triumphant crew, was deep into his final agonizing stint, the checkered flag just within grasp. A few hours earlier, he'd overheard teammate Raoul Bosel recounting a gearbox failure. Lammers could feel the transmission shaking a bit, and those same ominous sounds Bosel described were starting to creep up from below his seat. He knew what was coming, but decided to go all in and hope the gearbox held out. Every potential shift of the lever was a gamble, every corner a high-stakes wager against mechanical failure. But the Jag, a masterpiece of engineering meticulously prepared by Tom Walkinshaw, had been the fastest car on the track all day long. By lap 6, Lammers was in the lead. As dawn broke, the beast of a Jag had stolen the checkered flag from Porsche, shattering a 7-year dynasty and putting Tom Walkinshaw's name in the spotlight. It was a victory forged in engineering brilliance, driver tenacity, and Walkinshaw's unyielding will to win. A moment that perfectly encapsulated the man and his empire. How did a young Scottish farmer claw his way to F1 team ownership? How did a fairly unknown racer get picked up by Ford? And why did Jaguar trust a team owner facing a massive controversy with the relaunch of their racing ambitions? We're gonna find out. Today on Pass Gas, it's Tom Walkinshaw. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. My name is Nolan Sykes. I'm joined this week by Bart Bidlingmeyer across the table from me.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
You're welcome, Bart. Tom Walkinshaw, a name that I think has come up many times on the show so far.
It feels like we've done an episode on him
because he's
mentioned so much.
Yeah. I don't know. We've mentioned him so many times, Tom Walkinshaw. I'm just surprised we haven't done one on him yet. But here we are. It's finally the day. And we're going to make it happen here. Joe still out on paternity leave, but his baby is doing well. His little baby boys are doing well. Yeah.
And I know they bounced because I dropped one.
Oh, you did. Oh. So we are still anxiously awaiting Joe's return, which should be pretty soon, I think. A couple more weeks. One more week when you guys hear this. He'll be back. So looking forward to that.
Joe, Nolan, your teeth, I'm noticing, are very white.
Are they?
Do you whiten them?
No.
Never?
Are you serious?
Look at those chompers. Are you using a new toothpaste?
I am using
it. What are you using?
It's like some Colgate stuff.
All right.
Like really gritty though.
Okay.
Maybe. It's like a blue paste. It's super gritty.
I think red tube's something else.
But thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, no, they look great. Let me know what it is because it works, man.
Yeah, I'll try to remember. Okay, right. Send toothpaste to Bart. Send toothpaste to
just
Bart.
Just the name of it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll send you a whole case of it. Thank you. Yeah. I need to floss more.
Yeah. That's I wouldn't say that before I noticed they were brown or anything.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just noticing that they're quite a bright white now. So
that's
good for you.
Wow.
Man.
We should send this to maybe get a sponsorship.
All right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hand to God. Well, I'll start using it.
Yeah, we'll all just be blinding each other with our teeth. All right, let's get into the story of one Tom Walkinshaw. Tom Walkinshaw's story begins not alongside the gleaming chrome of a race shop or the roar of a Grand Prix circuit, but in the muck and grit of his family farm near, near Pennyquick in Midlothian, Scotland. I'm sure I did not pronounce either of those the native tongue. Mm-hmm. Born to a family of market farmers on August 14th, 1946, as a kid, he was thrown into the demands and unrelenting hard work and long hours that farmers faced in Scotland in the 1940s. This demanding upbringing was the origin story for his tenacity, and it instilled in young Tom a no-nonsense attitude and an extraordinary work ethic that defined his career. In our travels for the big trip, we've driven through a lot of like very rural, like agricultural areas, mm-hmm. and it always has me thinking like, that's a tough life, you know, getting up, working in, at the farm every morning. But I also think about there's times you'd be driving through somewhere and be like, what was this like in the 50s? In the 40s, when there were no, or not no modern conveniences, but like much less of them at least.
Sure.
Different kind of life altogether, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, I'm glad you're developing empathy finally.
Yeah, finally there. Tom knew early that there were no shortcuts and that he couldn't expect favors. And that even in a family business, there was an expectation to deliver on your promises. This attitude permeated his passion for racing. When he got a bit older, he drove hundreds of miles from his Scottish home to race circuits in England on the weekends, pushing the limits of his endurance, only to be back on the farm, ready for work at first light on Monday morning.
That's crazy. It's like training. Going to the race is training for endurance racing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Walkinshaw began his racing journey in 1968, taking baby steps and an MG midget into the racing world.
I almost wore my MG shirt today.
Oh, dang.
That would have been something, but I didn't. I worked out in it.
Oh,
so I had to.
Nice.
If you can picture that, I took it off.
It's interesting when you go down to like San Diego and also Mexico and see a bunch of little EV hatchbacks with the MG logo.
Yeah.
On them.
Yeah.
Weird. It's weird, dude. That's weird. So it didn't take long for Walkinshaw to jump to the more competitive Lotus Formula Ford car. And by 1969, Tom's innate talent was undeniable. He secured the Scottish FF 1600 title at the wheel of a Hawk, a remarkably swift ascent that showcased his raw speed and skill. It must have been riding all the tractors on the farm. During the early 1970s, Walkinshaw was trying to make a name for himself in the cutthroat world of single-seater racing. He moved to the British Formula 3 Championship with Lotus and later joined the March Works team. It was during this period that he faced his first tragedy, a crash at Brands Hatch, where he launched his March F3 car off the track and into the paddock, breaking his ankles and his fibula. This significant injury couldn't keep the stocky Scotsman at home, though. He continued to drive in various classes, including Formula 5000 and Formula 2, demonstrating a gritty determination that quickly became his trademark. Tom's stocky build and aggressive driving style had him looking more like Shrek on a donkey than the typical finesse possessed by other single-seat racers like Stirling Moss. Maybe it was his Scottish upbringing, but he ignored the celebrity and fashionable aspects of racing and focused on the actual racing. It was during those early days of the 70s that Walkinshaw began to realize his almost instinctual ability to perform test and development work at the track. It was a hard-won skill he shrewdly began to market to privateers, charging daily fees to handle their racing saloons. So he's basically like not a consultant, but like his gig is testing cars for teams and making them better. This marked a pivotal shift, which laid the foundation for his own future empire. The 1973 fuel crisis essentially ended his single-seating racing ambitions while inadvertently opening a new door at Ford. Walkinshaw took a gig doing all the sorting for Ford Escorts, which were starting to make a name for themselves on the rally circuit. In 1974, Ford had gotten Walkinshaw under contract to race their Capri on the British Touring Car Championship circuit, and he did exactly as everyone expected. He dominated the class so hard that his only rational choice from there was to launch his own racing team. Sometimes you got to do it. That's the only logical choice, Bart.
I told you I could do it. I'm going to go do it.
By 1976, Walkinshaw made a decisive pivot in his career away from working under the thumb of manufacturers. Recognizing his greater potential beyond merely being a driver, he built Tom Walkinshaw Racing on an industrial estate in Kidlington near Oxford, England. But this was no ordinary racing team. When I went to London, I liked London, but how charming everything is really got to me really quickly. I don't know
why. As like an annoyance?
It kind of annoyed me. Yeah. Everything had a really cute name. All the towns were very charming. It was just like, it's too much. Okay. It was too much.
Okay.
Maybe it was the neighborhood that I was located in. It was like near this giant park with a bunch of like, I think like Zendaya had a house near there. Maybe it was like,
okay,
you know, kind of upper crust, you know what I mean?
Got it.
So Walkinshaw Racing would be no ordinary racing team. Walkinshaw launched it with a manifesto to create a comprehensive group dedicating to the, quote, manufacture and design of racing and road cars. This strategic transition from driver to entrepreneurial powerhouse leveraged his growing engineering skills and his competitive drive to build a completely holistic motorsport and auto design firm. Their first client was BMW, who delivered the BMW 3.0 CSL to the Walkinshaw shop so that they could tweak and modify it for racing teams. That's a huge get mm-hmm. for a new company. That car, that's like, they call that like the Batwing or something like that, right? Yeah, very, very cool car. Although he transitioned to be the boss man, Walkinshaw was still an intimidating presence behind the wheel. He co-drove a Hermitite-sponsored BMW 3.5 CSL with John Fitzpatrick to a dramatic victory at the Silverstone 6 Hours in 1976, winning by a mere 1.3 seconds. This early success immediately showcased TWR's capabilities and proved that Walkinshaw could wear mechanics gloves just as easily as he could strap on racing gloves. The company's reputation for meticulous preparation and sorting race cars for teams continued to grow and attract the eager eyeballs of major manufacturers. Tom was known for being, quote, very picky, demanding perfection in every detail, and the bigwigs like that a lot. Perfectionism, often a trait of someone having ADHD, mm-hmm. I believe, hyperfixation, right?
Sure.
Something I learned later on in life. Anyway,
such a perfectionist, I never finish anything.
Exactly. Well, that's part of it.
I know.
Yeah. This uncompromising approach to quality and performance became a hallmark of TWR's operations, laying the groundwork for its unique ability to develop, build, and race cars for manufacturers. This was hard to find, but sought out extensively at this time. TWR quickly became a dominant force in touring car racing and demonstrated its engineering prowess and strategic skills. Mazda recognized TWR's abilities and got Walkinshaw on the horn, where they signed a contract with his outfit to head up its works program in the British Touring Car Championship, or BTCC. This partnership led to back-to-back titles for Win Percy in the TWR-developed RX-7 in 1980 and 81. Walkinshaw himself added a Spa 24-hour victory in 1981 with the rotary-powered coupe, proving its endurance capabilities and TWR's ability to extract maximum performance over long distances while keeping the rotary motor spinning.
That's cool. Did you see this year at the Car Week at Laguna Seca? Mm-hmm. They ran a bunch of the RX-7s, mm-hmm. so...
That's cool. The success continued with British Leyland as TWR prepared the Jaguar XJS and Rover 3500 Vitesse for both BTCC and the European Touring Car Championship. The 1983 British Saloon Car Championships became a defining moment for TWR's reputation. The TWR prepped Rover 3500 Vitesses with Steve Soper, Jeff Allam, and Pete Lovett at the wheel were insanely dominant, winning all 11 races in the season's calendar. Good Lord. Soper initially clinched the title, appearing to secure a clean sweep for the team. Yet, the victory was short-lived. Following a protest by ex-TWR driver Frank Sittner, now at BMW, a protracted legal battle ensued, and it kept Team Walkinshaw embroiled in a legal battle for the rest of the 1983 season.
That sucks.
That does suck. In July of 1984, Lord Hartley Shawcross delivered a damning verdict. He ruled that all of the Rover SD1s were disqualified due to, quote, bodywork irregularities and engine installation issues, including non-homologation engine components and, quote, inwardly widened rear arches to accommodate wider tires. So they're erasing the rule book a little too hard, it sounds mm-hmm. like. And when that happens, that means you're cheating.
Ego.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Controversy ensued, and Andy Rouse was handed the title by the courts. Rover, incensed by what they perceived as inconsistent scrutineering, withdrew from the series as a works entity entirely. The incident cast Walkinshaw's aggressive approach to rule interpretation in a very harsh light. Tom was willing to push the rules to the very edge of the boundaries, and a bit beyond, using his own aggressive ideas about what they truly meant, even if that could result in a giant DQ. This whole fracas gave some manufacturers pause, because they thought his idea of what was what could put their millions and millions of British pounds sterling straight into a wood chipper if another ruling like Lord Shawcross's name came down the pipeline. Tom's willingness to win at any cost, including bending the rules past the breaking point, was a pattern that would reoccur throughout his career. And while that may work in the startup world where companies can play fast and loose with investor money, car builders didn't like the sound of money being flushed down the toilet, especially in the mid-80s when the money wasn't there to flush.
Move fast and break things.
Yeah, move fast, break things. Ignore regulations. Destroy industries.
Kill them all and let God sort them out. Yeah.
Shoot first,
and that's it.
That's it.
Do not ask any questions or you'll regret it.
The string of successes with Rover and Mazda, coupled with Tom's notoriety gained from the Rover controversy, solidified TWR's reputation as
such thing as bad publicity.
Yeah, it solidified TWR's reputation as a team that could, quote, make slow cars win races if you were willing to take risks. This growing prestige caught the discerning eye of one John Egan, the ambitious chairman of Jaguar. After Jaguar's privatization in 1984... After Jag's privatization in 1984, Egan was determined to put the storied mark back on the map. Now that he no longer had shareholders to answer to, Walkinshaw was the perfect man to walk Team Jaguar right over the finish line. The stage was set for a strategic partnership that would redefine both companies. TWR's relationship with Jaguar officially began in 1982 with the successful entry of the Jaguar XJS into the European Touring Car Championship. 2 years later, in 1984, Walkinshaw piloted the XJS to the ETCC title. This initial collaboration laid the groundwork for what would become TWR's most successful partnership and iconic era, Jaguar's return to global endurance racing. Yeah. Whoa. Interesting. Look at this thing. That's cool.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine that thing going around a racetrack. Seems like a big old land yacht. Team Walkinshaw's success in touring cars demonstrated their capability to deliver wins, which made them the perfect partner for Jag's ambitious Group C plans, which at the time was the pinnacle class in prototype racing. This would be the biggest challenge that TWR had ever faced, and it required a monumental leap in engineering sophistication alongside a strategic vision for global dominance. The visionary Walkinshaw understood that success at this level demanded the best minds in the business, and he quickly assembled a super band of engineering badasses like Tony Southgate, who designed the revolutionary XJR cars from a blank sheet of paper, and one Ross Braun, an absolute Formula One legend. We actually talked about Braun GP in an episode a few years ago. That whole thing. They won a F1 championship with Jenson Button.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This infusion of top-tier talent and a commitment to applying Formula One-level technology to sports car racing was a game-changer. Walkinshaw's team made their Group C debut in 1985 with a carbon fiber chassis and a highly tuned V12 stuffed into a vehicle known as the Jaguar XJR6. This car showed immediate promise, leading the opening laps of its first race, a clear sign of the intense power and aerodynamic efficiency that was to come. Oh yeah, look at this thing.
Yep.
It's cool.
I think it's...
yep.
You recognize it once you look. You're like, oh yeah, I've seen that. Yeah. I remember this car.
That's neat. Very green. Love that. Dude, it's so cool.
Yeah.
5-spoke wheels in the front and 4-spoke in the back.
Hell yeah, brother.
Pretty cool. The immense investment and relentless effort poured into the Group C program paid off spectacularly. TWR Jaguar cars achieved outright victories in the World Sports Car Championship in 1987, 88, and 1991. The XJR8 secured the WSCC Teams Championship in 1987, followed by the iconic XJR9 in 1988, which also clinched the prestigious 24 Hours of Le Mans. Oh, yeah. So this is the purple and yellow one. Purple, white, yellow with the covered rear wheel.
Yep.
XJR9, baby. That thing's so cool. This 1988 victory with the Jan Lammers, Andy Wallace, and Johnny Dumfries crew was monumental. We've talked about Johnny Dumfries before. Oh, good old Johnny Dumps. Johnny Dumfries. This was the first Le Mans win for Jaguar since 1957, which shamed Porsche when their seven-year winning streak was shattered. Martin Brundle, driving for TWR Jaguar, also secured the WSCC Drivers' Championship in 1988, further cementing the team's absolute dominance. 2 years later, the XJR12, a derivative of the XJR9, returned to Le Mans to claim victory again in 1990, securing TWR's place in endurance racing lore. Beyond the hallowed grounds of Le Mans, TWR Jaguar also triumphed at the Daytona 24 Hours both in 1988 and 1990. It was win after win after win for Team Walkinshaw. Even after Jaguar's official withdrawal from WSCC due to rule changes, TWR continued to win at Le Mans in 1996 and 97 with the Porsche-powered WSC 95. It's an open-top Porsche car.
Cool.
Pretty neat. This proved that TWR could cross the finish line first in cars made by different folks.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now, back to the show.
The unparalleled success on the track led to ambitious plans for the road. TWR and Jaguar formalized their partnership in 1988, creating a 50-50 joint venture aptly named Jaguar Sport. Initially, Jaguar Sport focused on building tuned versions of Jaguar road cars, such as the XJR S Coupe and XJR Saloon, benefiting directly from TWR's extensive racing experience in European touring cars. This collaboration created two exclusive sports cars from the all-new facility in Buxom, the race-derived XJR 15 and the ultimate hypercar, one of my favorites ever, the XJ220. The XJR 15, developed in 1991, was a 500,000 British pound sterling, fully road legal car based directly on the Le Mans winning XJR 9 chassis. It featured a slightly smaller but highly tuned 6-liter V12, producing a whopping 450 ponies, which at the time was a lot. At the time,
it's a big engine, yeah.
At the time, the Big Three's best pony cars were cresting just 200 horsepower, and the poster-worthy Ferrari Testarossa was pushing only 385. Okay, I think I've seen this before. This guy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's funny that it's not a more known car. That should be a poster car.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't at that time.
I think it got overshadowed by the eventual XJ220. Mm-hmm. The XJ220 proved to be a bit more controversial. Originally conceived as a V12 all-wheel drive concept car at the 1988 British Motor Show, TWR was tasked with translating this bold vision into reality. In the interest of performance, weight savings, and financial viability, TWR made significant and frowned upon changes, most notably switching to a twin-turbo 3.5-liter V6 derived from the MG Metro 6R4 Group B rally car and giving the car rear-wheel drive. Well, dude, that Metro 6R4 is not to be trifled with. Mm-hmm. That thing is a badass.
Yeah, the Geo Metro 6R4. Geo Metro.
This decision, driven by emissions regulations and packaging concerns, led to buyer dissatisfaction and even some ambitious lawsuits by superfans of the brand, especially as the car launched into a global recession. Despite the controversy, as they say over there, the XJ220 was briefly the fastest production car in the world in 1992 when it hit 213 miles per hour a few months before the Bugatti EB110 put the Jag back in the paddock. Back to pasture, maybe.
I don't know. I mean, either one.
Out to pasture.
Back in the paddock. Either way, it's not racing.
To carry
this horse metaphor.
Yes. Tom Walkinshaw's long-held ambition to conquer Formula One was palpable. In 1991, he made his move and acquired a 35% stake in the Benetton F1 squad and joined as engineering director. This controversial period proved to be a pivotal chapter in his career. Walkinshaw was instrumental in the recruitment of a young German named Michael Schumacher, who had been quite impressive during his sports car racing days. Under Walkinshaw's engineering leadership, Benetton went on to achieve unprecedented success, culminating in Michael Schumacher winning the 1994 Formula One World Championship. Not bad. Pretty cool.
Is that year one?
In 91, he acquired it 3 years later.
They won, so 94.
However, this period of triumph was not without its problems. During the 94 season, the Benetton team faced intense scrutiny for suspected technical shenanigans, including the potential use of banned electronic aids and unauthorized modifications to refueling apparatuses.
Is that old race in the rule book again? Yeah.
The racing overlords found illegal software in the Benettons, but the FIA had no evidence of its use during races, so there's no punishment for Walkinshaw at the time. This incident brought some sour reminders of the 1983 Rover controversy and led to a subsequent falling out with Benetton team principal Flavio Briatore. But while the Benetton door closed, Walkinshaw tore open a new door he'd been staring at for a long time, labeled full F1 team ownership. There you go.
Yep. Why don't you just open that if the door's there? It's labeled.
I would simply open the door. It wasn't until 1996 that Walkinshaw finally achieved his ambition of full F1 team ownership, purchasing a majority stake in the Arrows F1 team, which was then known as Footwork. To signal his serious intent and prove that he, quote, meant business, he pulled off a major coup for the 1997 season. He signed reigning world champion Damon Hill to his squad, and the season began with a bizarre and controversial disqualification for both Arrows cars at the Australian Grand Prix after they stalled on the starting grid, an ominous sign of the unreliability that was about to plague the team. Despite persistent engine struggles with their Yamaha V10s, which were notoriously unreliable, a moment of tantalizing glory arrived at the 1997 Hungarian Grand Prix. Hill, starting third, sensationally passed Walkinshaw's old friend Michael Schumacher and took the lead, holding it comfortably until just two laps from the finish when a rubber seal in the hydraulic system failed and he barely clung to second place. Walkinshaw's dream of F1 glory quickly unraveled. Arrows continued to struggle with attracting consistent sponsorship and building a competitive, reliable car. Financial woes escalated, leading to significant operating losses, reaching £5.8 million in 1998 alone. The team attempted to build its own engines, but its resources proved insufficient to compete in modern F1. They should have just thrown a small block Chevy in there.
Sure.
The situation was compounded.
No one fixed F1.
Yeah. The situation was compounded by the bizarre and ultimately disastrous involvement of Prince Malik Adu Ibrahim, who was a, quote, colorful Nigerian prince.
Oh, I got an email from him.
Who bought a 25% share in 1999. The prince promised substantial funding through his, quote, T-minus brand, which adorned the car for most of the year. However, he failed to deliver on his promises, and the T-minus brand generated, quote, absolutely no money, with Arrow's employees stating it was, quote, simply a dream in the prince's head. Morgan Grenfell, another investor, had to cover the losses with long-term loans to keep the team afloat. The cars became increasingly slow and unreliable, battling with traditional backmarkers like Minardi. By 2002, the financial strain proved too much. The Arrows team ran out of money and was forced into liquidation. As TWR was the major shareholder of Arrows, the immense costs resulting from the F1 team's failure triggered the demise of Walkinshaw's entire racing group, which was placed into bankruptcy.
Oh.
Dang, dude. I can't really imagine what it's like to go through this whole process. So in less than 10 years, or around 10 years, like buying a share in a team, it, you know, you guys win, but like under questionable circumstances, that's already putting you on some shaky ground. Then buying a team sounds like firing a lot of people, then getting a very mysterious investor who turns out to be a fraud.
Yeah.
Stuff is not going well at the track. Like, got to be super off kilter during all this, man. That's tough.
The second time you said kilt.
I'm sorry. It's on my mind. Man, that's tough.
Yeah.
While Tom's global empire crumbled under the weight of F1 ambitions, Walkinshaw's influence on Australian motorsport remained remarkably resilient, a testament to his long-term vision and deep ties to the market. His involvement began in 1984 with an early trip to Bathurst, bringing mobile-backed Rovers to compete in Group A racing. He returned in 1985 with three V12 Jaguar XJS race cars, securing an outright victory at Mount Panorama with John Goss and Armin Hahn. This early success laid the groundwork for a much deeper and enduring relationship. The enduring partnership with Holden, which began back in 1987, led to the establishment of Holden Special Vehicles, or HSV, as a joint venture, effectively replacing the controversial Holden dealer team. HSV specialized in modifying and producing sportier versions of Holden's cars for domestic and export sales. Okay, this is...
Yeah.
I think we... This is why I know Walkinshaw's name, because we talked a lot about him, and I think... some Aussie racing stuff, but also I think the GTR episode we mentioned him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've... Okay. The first car developed by HSV, the VL Commodore SS Group A SV. Long, guys. We got to stop with these names. Designed for Group A touring car racing homologation, went on to win the 1990 Bathurst 1000. From this foundation, the iconic Holden Racing Team, or HRT, was born in 1990, becoming Holden's factory-backed outfit and the most prestigious and successful team in Australian touring car history. HRT amassed an incredible 7 Bathurst 1000 victories and 6 driver championship wins. Even after TWR's collapse in the UK in 2002, the Australian arm of the business was sold to Holden. Walkinshaw maintained a complicated relationship with HRT, eventually reacquiring full control of the team in 2008. His relentless desire for success continued, with the supercar team eventually re-emerging as Walkinshaw Andretti United, continuing the powerful legacy Walkinshaw Racing had built in Australia. This enduring success in Australia proved a crucial lifeline and positive reminder that demonstrated Walkinshaw's ability to build lasting, impactful ventures even amidst global setbacks. Tom Walkinshaw was a man of stark contrasts, a towering figure who inspired both fierce loyalty and sharp criticism throughout his illustrious, yet often tumultuous career. Those who worked closely with him often described him as a tough nut or a ruthless man who, quote, pushed boundaries and ruffled feathers. He was notorious for his aggressive negotiating style, often getting precisely what he wanted and possessing the uncanny knack of convincing others that his desires were in fact their own. Yet, this demanding exterior masked a profound ability to inspire others. He was widely lauded as a motivator and an inspiring leader. His relentless drive to win, his innate racer's instinct, was infectious, inspiring those around him to achieve milestones that seemed impossible to others. Tom Walkinshaw passed in 2010 at the age of 64, leaving behind a complex, indelible mark on motorsport and the broader automotive world. He was a trailblazer, a lateral thinker, and above all, a winner, whose influence continues to resonate through the sport he loved, a testament to a life lived at full throttle. And that is the story of Tom Walkinshaw.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that's the Australian thread. Mm-hmm. It was pretty cool that all of that was still going on. So by the time everything collapsed in F1, he was like, you know what?
Yeah. I'm just going to go chill.
Chill
with the Aussies.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't familiar with all the like British touring car stuff.
Right.
That's why I thought he was Australian. This whole, when you started reading,
got
I was
it.
Like, he's Scottish? Oh, crap. Mm-hmm. Probably didn't pay attention to those earlier episodes. Probably could have picked up on that.
Maybe. You know, maybe we just didn't say it. Maybe we just mentioned his name and what he developed.
Yeah, and just assumed. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. Big thanks to our crew, Audrey, Mark, and Edgar behind the camera, and our writer this week, Jacob Desjarlais. You can follow Bart at BidsBardo on social media. You can follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. We also have an Instagram page and YouTube channel for this show. You can watch our faces tell the story instead of just listening to it if you're just listening. You can find our podcast on every podcast app out there. Listen at work. Listen on your drive. Listen while you're doing the dishes like I do. Okay, so we will see you next week. Joe's going to be back, and he's going to be even more father-like than ever, I assume. All right.
He'll be more tired than before.
Yeah, more tired than ever. Or maybe this will be, maybe his second one's an easier one. You know? I don't know. We'll see.
You never know till you know.
Yeah.
The thing, when you have the second kid, you definitely have a number of moments where it's like, ah, shit, how did I forget about this? This part that sucks.
Well, can't wait to hear about that. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.